Okay, so today we're going to resume our study of 1 Kings with chapter 11. I know the last time that we met, we had about 10 minutes left in our session, and we'd exhausted the previous chapters. And so we sort of stuck a toe into chapter 11. But I think it needs more treatment than that, because it's a sort of a pivotal a piece of 1 and 2 Kings. This is the beginning of the end for the United Kingdom, not the one that's leaving the EU, but the United Kingdom of Israel. And then in the following chapter, chapter 12, which I hope we can cover today, we begin to see that break actually occurring. So we're going to read 11, talk through that a little bit, and if we have time for 12, we'll plunge in there as well. King Solomon loved many foreign women, along with the daughter of Pharaoh, Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women, from the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the Israelites, "You shall not enter into marriage with them, neither shall they with you, for they will surely incline your heart to follow their gods." Solomon clung to these in love. Among his wives were 700 princesses and 300 concubines, and his wives turned away his heart. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned away his heart after other gods, and his heart was not true to the Lord his God, as was the heart of his father David. For Solomon followed Astarte, the goddess of the Sidonians, and Milcom, the abomination of the Ammonites. So Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not completely follow the Lord as his father David had done. Then Solomon built a high place for Chemosh, the abomination of Moab, and for Moloch, the abomination of the Ammonites, on the mountain east of Jerusalem. He did the same for all his foreign wives, who offered incense and sacrifice to their gods. Then the Lord was angry with Solomon because his heart had turned away from the Lord, the God of Israel, who had appeared to him twice and had commanded him concerning this matter, that he should not follow other gods, but he did not observe what the Lord commanded. Therefore the Lord said to Solomon, "Since this has been your mind, and you have not kept my covenant and my statutes that I have commanded you, I will surely tear the kingdom from you and give it to your servant. Yet for the sake of your father David, I will not do it in your lifetime. I will tear it out of the hand of your son. I will not, however, tear away the entire kingdom. I will give one tribe to your son for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, which I have chosen." Then the Lord raised up an adversary against Solomon, Hadad the Edomite. He was of the royal house of Edom. For when David was in Edom and Joab, the commander of the army, went to bury the dead, he killed every male in Edom, for Joab and all Israel remained there 6 months until he had eliminated every male in Edom. But Hadad fled to Egypt with some Edomites who were servants of his father. He was a young boy at that time. They set out from Midian and came to Paran. They took people with them from Paran and came to Egypt, to Pharaoh, king of Egypt, who gave him a house, assigned him an allowance of food, and gave him land. Hadad found great favor in the sight of Pharaoh, so that he gave him his sister-in-law for a wife, the sister of Queen Tafinis. The sister of Tafinis gave birth by him to his son Genubath, whom Tafinis weaned in Pharaoh's house. Genubath was in Pharaoh's house among the children of Pharaoh. When Hadad heard in Egypt that David slept with his ancestors and that Joab, the commander of the army, was dead, Hadad said to Pharaoh, "Let me depart, that I may go to my own country." But Pharaoh said to him, "What do you lack with me, that you now seek to go to your own country?" And he said, "No, do let me go." God raised up another adversary against Solomon, Razan, son of Elida, who had fled from his master, King Hadadezer of Zobah. He gathered followers around him and became leader of a marauding band after the slaughter by David. They went to Damascus, settled there, and made him king in Damascus. He was an adversary of Israel all the days of Solomon, making trouble as Hadad did. He despised Israel and reigned over Aram. Jeroboam, son of Nebat, an Ephraimite of Zeredah, a servant of Solomon, whose mother's name was Zeruah, a widow, rebelled against the king. The following was the reason he rebelled against the king. Solomon built the Milo and closed up the gap in the wall of the city of his father David. The man Jeroboam was very able, and when Solomon saw that the young man was industrious, he gave him charge over all the forced labor of the house of Joseph. About that time, when Jeroboam was leaving Jerusalem, the prophet Ahijah the Shilonite found him on the road. Ahijah had clothed himself with a new garment. The two of them were alone in the open country. When Ahijah laid hold of the new garment he was wearing and tore it into 12 pieces. Then he said to Jeroboam, "Take for yourself 10 pieces, for thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, see, I am about to tear the kingdom from the hand of Solomon and will give you 10 tribes. One tribe will remain his for the sake of my servant David and for the sake of Jerusalem, the city that I have chosen out of all the tribes of Israel. This is because he has forsaken me, worshipped Astarte, the goddess of the Sidonians, Chemosh, the god of Moab, and Milcom, the god of the Ammonites, and has not walked in my ways, doing what is right in my sight and keeping my statutes and my ordinances as his father David did. Nevertheless, I will not take the whole kingdom away from him, but will make him ruler all the days of his life, for the sake of my servant David, whom I chose, and who did keep my commandments and my statutes. But I will take the kingdom away from his son and give it to you, that is, the 10 tribes. Yet to his son I will give 1 tribe, so that my servant David may always have a lamp before me in Jerusalem, the city where I have chosen to put my name. I will take you, and you shall reign over all that your soul desires. You shall be king over Israel. If you will listen to all that I command you, walk in my ways, and do what is right in my sight by keeping my statutes and my commandments, as David my servant did, I will be with you, and will build you an enduring house, as I built for David, and I will give Israel to you. For this reason, I will punish the descendants of David, but not forever." Solomon sought therefore to kill Jeroboam, but Jeroboam promptly fled to Egypt, to King Shishak of Egypt, and remained in Egypt until the death of Solomon. Now the rest of the acts of Solomon, all that he did, as well as his wisdom, are they not written in the book of the Acts of Solomon? The time that Solomon reigned in Jerusalem over all Israel was 40 years. Solomon slept with his ancestors and was buried in the city of his father David, and his son Rehoboam succeeded him. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Okay, so Solomon, as many political leaders do and have done forever, had significant appetites. And to that end, he wound up with 700 wives and 300 concubines, and apparently a lot of them were not Israelite women. These were foreigners who the Torah clearly and repeatedly says, you can't marry these people. And that just doesn't just go for the king, it goes for all of the Israelites. So for the king to do it sort of makes it double bad. And the reason wasn't ethnic. It wasn't about purity of blood. It was about the fact that they were the only ones who were practicing monotheism. They were the only ones worshiping the one true God. Everybody else was polytheistic, and they had gods for all sorts of different things. And God knew that if these Ammonites and Moabites and Sidonians were married to an Israelite, that eventually they would persuade them of the value of these gods, or at least convince their husbands that they should be allowed freedom of religious expression to continue worshiping the gods they had prior to marriage. So that's what happens. And he ends up worshiping a pantheon of foreign gods. And what's worse, he ends up building sacrificial sites for them, some of which were on the mountain east of Jerusalem. So these temples to these foreign gods were literally sort of looking down on the temple complex itself. This was unacceptable. This is a violation of the very first commandment. You shall have no other gods but me. And so God got angry, understandably. He'd already talked to him twice. He'd given him wisdom, and from wisdom everything else had followed. Secure political power, peace with his neighbors, immense wealth, and the acclamation of the people. You know, so that's gratitude for you, huh? And I guess that's what happens sometimes when, you know, people like Solomon have everything the world has to offer. You sort of get this attitude, you can do whatever you want. So God speaks again a third time to Solomon and says, this is the end, my friend. I'm going to tear the kingdom away from you. Now I'm going to leave you one. I'm going to leave you one piece, a remnant, Judah. Now, Benjamin was also in the area of the southern kingdom. And it's debatable among scholars whether or not Benjamin was kind of like a Switzerland, sort of a largely non-aligned tribe, although they did tend to lean toward Judah, in part because relatively Judah was a larger, much more powerful tribe than Benjamin. And he does this not for Solomon's sake, but in order to fulfill the covenant that he made with David, that the covenant promise would continue to run through David's line. So God sort of is technically doing that by reserving Jerusalem and Judah for Solomon's leadership and his son's leadership. Although none of this is going to happen until Solomon dies. So it's sort of we're just going to let bygones be bygones. But buddy, once you're in the tomb, all hell's going to break loose. Then we have three opponents, starting in verse 14 of chapter 11, rising up against Solomon. And you hear echoes here of Joseph and Moses and of David himself, with Solomon in the very uncomfortable role of Pharaoh, which is something that will be emphasized more strongly in chapter 12, and also Saul. So Hadad the Edomite comes up, and he was a survivor of essentially a genocide that was committed when Joab, commander of David's army, conquered Edom and killed everybody. But he got away, and he fled to Egypt as a young boy. So there are some resonances of Joseph. Now, Joseph got to Egypt by a different route. He was betrayed by his brothers. We all know that. But when he got to Egypt, Pharaoh included him within the royal household, gave him a member of the royal household for a wife. They bore a son together. He was raised in Pharaoh's house, not unlike Moses. And Hadad finds out that David's dead, that Joab's dead, and he's like, this is an opportune time. And of course, you may remember that Joseph received a dream from angels in Bethlehem saying, Herod's coming and he's going to kill all the kids. Get Mary and Jesus out of here. And what do? They went to Egypt and they stayed until they heard that Herod was dead, and then they went back. So he asked Pharaoh to let him go in words very similar to the message that Moses and Aaron delivered from God. Let my people go. Let me depart, that I may go to my own country. And Pharaoh's not been oppressive toward Hadad. But he says, why would you want to? I mean, your life is good here. And he says, no, do let me go. And then you've got Rezin, son of Elada. Now, he had fled from a master and became a marauding band after the slaughter of David. And what was David under the reign of King Saul? He led a small cohort of soldiers who went around marauding the countryside, living as best they could, and trying to escape Saul's murderous intentions. They wind up in Damascus in present-day Syria established a kingdom there. And then you have Jeroboam. And Jeroboam is the sole Israelite in this trio. And he got upset because Solomon built the Milo and closed the gap in the city wall. We talked about his construction projects, which included this, and the fact that this word has many different meanings in Hebrew depending on its context. But it's pretty clear here that he closes up the gap in the wall, and it tells us explicitly that he built it for his wife, who was the daughter of Pharaoh, probably as a way to set her apart and above his many, many other wives and concubines. Now, why Jeroboam got mad at that, Lord only knows. Did you have a question, Beverly?
Milo. What's a Milo?
It can be a lot of different things, but in this context, it's a structure that closes up a gap in the defensive wall of a city. Yeah. Jeroboam was a young man of great talent. And Solomon, recognizing the talent, put him in charge of forced labor. And we've talked about how pharaonic this was for Solomon to do, compel people to work in the timber yards and in the stone quarries for the building of the temple and for the much more massive royal complex in Jerusalem. And Jeroboam is sort of wandering around, bumps into a prophet, and the prophet has a brand new suit. And he takes it and he rips it up into 12 pieces. Okay? And, of course, this reminds us of how Samuel approached David during the reign of King Saul and said, you're next. God's chosen you. Because Saul is clearly completely out of his skull, and he has not followed the commandments of God and has offended God, and so there's going to be a change. And of course, you also remember that Saul went into a cave to do a number two, and while he was there, David's buddy said, why don't you go kill him? This is the best shot you're going to get. He doesn't. Instead, he slices off a piece of the cloak so that later he can say, hey, you think that I'm trying to overthrow you. Well, I could have just run you through in that cave in the most embarrassing of all ways, but instead, I just sliced your cloak off. Okay? But that was still a symbol of things to come. So these 12 pieces of the cloak represent the 12 tribes of Israel. He gives 10 to Jeroboam, the northern tribes that will soon comprise Israel. The one of Judah being left over, and Benjamin kind of the status not entirely known. He explains why, which we've already talked about, Solomon's worship of foreign and false gods. And Jeroboam gets the same commission that Saul and David and Solomon got. You can be the boss, but you've got to do what I command you. You have to follow my statutes and ordinances. You have to be faithful to the covenant. This is the deal. Because I'm the kingmaker. There is none other. And, just look at what's happening to Solomon. You know, things are going to be okay till he's dead, but what a legacy he's leaving for his children. And of course, Saul, realizing that Jeroboam was in a very similar position to his father David, relative to Saul, tries to kill him. So Solomon kind of goes all Saul on Jeroboam. And Jeroboam goes to Egypt, to King Shishak, and stays there until Solomon dies. Now, it closes up with Solomon's death, which is passed over in a single verse. he's dead, good riddance. And verse 41 talks about the book of the Acts of Solomon. Now, we don't have this book per se, but what we do have are works that are widely ascribed to Solomon's authorship. The Song of Solomon, which is kind of an extended romantic sexual metaphor about the people of Israel being the bridegroom of God and the beauty of God and of the people. Proverbs were most likely written by Solomon, and of course many of the Psalms were credited to him, so maybe the books of the Acts of Solomon comprised of these elements that we still have in the Old Testament of the Bible, but there could have been more than that, because as you recall, he was a prolific composer of music, regarded as the wisest man in the world at the time. So the house is starting to crumble because the first commandment has been violated. God takes decisive action because the king has become immensely powerful. We've seen evidence of that in the previous chapters. The king has also become oppressive. And so one could see this as God not only punishing Solomon and his descendants, but also weakening both kingships, because they will now be in opposition to one another as well as to their neighbors. This is a way to dilute the overbearing power of the monarchy. So questions, things that you're seeing that I'm missing in chapter 11 of 1 Kings? David.
First thing. Mm-hmm. I find it odd that they talk about that, and Solomon did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and did not follow the Lord fully as David his father did. Have they already forgotten?
Yeah. Well, you know how it is. You know, in retrospect, everybody looks better. You know, for people who dislike our current president, they're waxing nostalgically about when George W. Bush was our president, even though at that time everybody was like, oh my God, this guy's an awful president. So it's a matter of comparison. David did some nasty stuff. The whole Bathsheba thing was a really bad one. But Solomon, his idolatry and the scale of his idolatry, it's just beyond the pale. So comparatively, David was in many ways better than his son, although he certainly had his own faults that are sort of being plastered over here in verse 6. So,
was David repentant and Solomon was not? Is that a difference?
Yes, David did repent. And Solomon was very humble before God. And he was for a time very faithful toward God. I think the relationship was just different. God had a love for David that I think transcended all others. And Solomon, as David's son, remained in God's favor. But you don't have this sense of emotional intensity, if that's the right word to use for God, with Solomon as you do for David. God's good to him, but there's this, I don't know, there's just kind of this connection there between David and God.
When they refer to some of these guys as kings, had the desert the kingdoms go by?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how big is Zoba? Is that more just like a tribe? You think? I mean, kingdoms like the king of France, the king of England, and all that.
Oh, yeah, these were much smaller territories. And I guess a more modern example would be if you were to look at a map of Europe, say in the 18th century, early 19th century, you would see score upon score of these tiny little feudal estates in the region that we now know as Germany. With the means of transportation and communication that they had around 1000 BC, there were a lot of small kingdoms. Holding together a really large territory was difficult. This was more of a tribal rather than a national period in the sort of political emergence of humanity. Now, you did have big kingdoms like Egypt. Within a few centuries, you're going to have the rise of kingdoms that are larger and more sophisticated and more powerful, like Assyria and Babylon and things like that. We don't know the exact extent of the kingdom of Zoba, but he would sort of be like more than that. It would be sort of like the Duchy of Württemberg or whatever. I'm just pulling that out of a hat. So, well, you want to jump into chapter 12? We can always come back to 11 if things occur to you. So, Here we go. Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had come to Shechem to make him king. When Jeroboam, son of Nebat, heard it, for he was still in Egypt, where he had fled from King Solomon, then Jeroboam returned from Egypt, and they sent and called him, and Jeroboam and all the assembly of Israel came and said to Rehoboam, "Your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the hard service of your father and his heavy yoke that he placed on us, and we will serve you." He said to them, "Go away for 3 days, then come to me again." So the people went away. Then King Rehoboam took counsel with the older men who had attended his father Solomon while he was still alive, saying, "How do you advise me to answer this people?" They answered him, "If you will be a servant to this people today and serve them and speak good words to them when you answer them, then they will be your servants forever." But he disregarded the advice that the older men gave him and consulted with the young men who had grown up with him and now attended him. He said to them, "What do you advise that we answer this people who have said to me, 'Lighten the yoke that your father put on us'?" The young men who had grown up with him said to him, "Thus you should say to this people who spoke to you, 'Your father made our yoke heavy, but you must lighten it for us.' Thus you should say to them, 'My little finger is thicker than my father's loins. Now whereas my father laid on you a heavy yoke, I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions.'" Yeah, take that. So Jeroboam and all the people came to Rehoboam the third day, as the king had said, "Come to me again the third day." The king answered the people harshly. He disregarded the advice that the older men had given him and spoke to them according to the advice of the young men. "My father made your yoke heavy, but I will add to your yoke. My father disciplined you with whips, but I will discipline you with scorpions." So the king did not listen to the people, because it was a turn of affairs brought about by the Lord, that he might fulfill his word, which the Lord had spoken by Ahijah the Shilonite to Jeroboam, son of Nebat. When all Israel saw that the king would not listen to them, the people answered the king, "What share do we have in David? We have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. To your tents, O Israel. Look now to your own house, O David." So Israel went away to their tents. But Rehoboam reigned over the Israelites who were living in the towns of Judah. When King Rehoboam sent Adoram, who was taskmaster over the forced labor, all Israel stoned him to death. But King Rehoboam then hurriedly mounted his chariot to flee to Jerusalem. So Israel has been in rebellion against the house of David to this day. When all Israel heard that Jeroboam had returned, they sent and called him to the assembly and made him king over all Israel. There was no one who followed the house of David except the tribe of Judah alone. When Rehoboam came to Jerusalem, he assembled all the house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 chosen troops, to fight against the house of Israel to restore the kingdom to Rehoboam, son of Solomon. But the word of God came to Shimei, the man of God, say to King Rehoboam of Judah, son of Solomon, and to all the house of Judah and Benjamin, and to the rest of the people, thus says the Lord, you shall not go up or fight against your kindred, the people of Israel. Let everyone go home, for this thing is from me. So they heeded the word of the Lord and went home again according to the word of the Lord. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and resided there. He went out from there and built Penuel. Then Jeroboam said to himself, now the kingdom may well revert to the house of David, if this people continues to go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem. The heart of this people will turn again to their master, King Rehoboam of Judah. They will kill me and return to King Rehoboam of Judah. So the king took counsel and made 2 calves of gold. He said to the people, you have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. Here are your gods, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. He sent one in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. And this thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one at Bethel and before the other as far as Dan. He also made houses on high places and appointed priests from among all the people who were not Levites. Jeroboam appointed a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the festival that was in Judah, and he offered sacrifices on the altar. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he had made. And he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places that he had made. He went up to the altar that he had made in Bethel on the 15th day in the 8th month, in the month that he alone had devised. He appointed a festival for the people of Israel, and he went up to the altar to offer incense. The word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Uh-oh. So, they go up to Shechem, and this is a very important place in the history of Israel. You can read more about it in Deuteronomy 27 and Joshua 24. That should be in the footnotes in your study Bible. The idea could have been twofold. One could have been that Rehoboam was thinking, I'll go up to the northern tribes. This is a gesture on my part, that I'm willing to leave Jerusalem and meet them where they are for them to acclaim me king. It also could have been an assertion of power that I'm your boss and I am taking over this very sacred symbolic site in the history of our people as the place where my kingship will be acclaimed. Jeroboam finds out Solomon's dead. He comes back, and the people come to Rehoboam and says, Solomon was a very pharaoh-like figure to us. We know it was a time of peace and prosperity, but with all the building that he did, he just bled us dry. So we need a respite, and we would like for you to be a different type of king than your father. Have as many wives as you want, write all the songs that your heart desires, but please stop all this forced labor business and stop taking all of our sheep and cattle and such a large proportion of our crops. So Rehoboam stalls for time. Well, give me 3 days to think about it. And he counsels the older men. These would have been Solomon's advisors. And they said, you'd better give them what they want. Because if you serve them as king now, then this will endear them to you, and they will be loyal to you. But he ignored them, and he went with his own cohort instead. These were kind of his cronies who had grown up in the court with him. Young men, actually, even though these guys would have been in their 40s, young men in Hebrews is actually boys. And so they're being called little children. And rightly so, because their advice is terrible. They said, not only tell them that you're not going to give them what they asked for, you tell them that they hadn't seen nothing yet. That your dad Solomon was a sissy, and you're going to show them what a real king's all about. You know, whips. Who needs whips? Scorpions. And it's probably not like real scorpions. This could be a euphemism for a type of whip that had bones and other sharp things embedded in the tail of the whip. So they all get together on the third day, and Rehoboam lays down the law to them, naturally, they don't like it. And there's a little vulgarity in here at the end of verse 10. My little finger is thicker than my father's loins. He's not really talking about his little finger. There are areas in Scripture where sensitivities are observed in translation. We'll put it that way. It was a turn of affairs, it says in verse 15, brought about by the Lord that he might fulfill his word. And it's intriguing here because we've talked before about all of the conspiracy to put Solomon on the throne. He was not the eldest son. So there's a lot going on, and Solomon was completely passive in all of this. He was around, but he wasn't doing anything to advance his own cause. God was working this out through other people, usually in some pretty nasty ways. Same thing with David. David really was not actively trying to overthrow Saul. He had multiple chances to kill him, never took advantage of it because he regarded the person of the king as sacred because he was an anointed one of God. But it was God working through others, including causing this madness to descend upon Saul that moved events to the point where David became king. So again, the text, as it's done so many times before, emphasizes that this isn't because Jeroboam was such a great guy. Because, as we're going to see shortly, he was not such a great guy. It's because God wanted this to happen. And the Israelites heard what Rehoboam had to say. And they said, you know, we're not part of his tribe. And we're distant relations. So let's go home to your tents. Let's, you know, we're going to take our ball and go home. And you guys just do your own thing. So Rehoboam reigned. He sent Adoram, which was a stupid, stupid choice. I mean, he sent the taskmaster over forced labor, and they stoned him to death, you know. And I just imagine Adoram saying, you know, is this really a good idea? They're pretty mad with you, and I know they're pretty mad with me. Could we find a more neutral figure? And Rehoboam, terrified, goes to Jerusalem, and then they make Jeroboam king, and there's just the one tribe in the southern kingdom with Benjamin, kind of as a buffer, really, between the two. And Rehoboam summons an army, again, 130,000 from these two tribes, as with so many of the figures we see, an exaggeration for narrative purposes. But God comes to a holy man, a prophet, and astonishingly, Rehoboam listens to him. Let everyone go home, for this thing is from me. Then Jeroboam sets up in Shechem, went out and built Penuel, which may be familiar from the story of Jacob. And he sort of has the law laid down to him by God again. But Rehoboam's worried. He's like, if these people keep going down to Jerusalem to the temple to offer their sacrifices, I'm never going to really pull them away from the house of David. Eventually this kingdom will collapse. We have to have our own centers of worship. And so he constructs two calves of gold. As we saw in Exodus, that's generally a bad idea. It starts out, okay, this is a good guy. He's a Moses-like figure. No, 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 no. He's more of an Aaron-like figure. And in these echoes, history repeats itself, especially for those who are ignorant of it and set it aside. So he puts one in Bethel, which had been consistently a site of worship, and the other way up in Dan toward the north. The people were worshiping there. He made even more places of worship on top of mountains. And then, to compound these terrible errors, he appointed priests that weren't Levites. You can't do that. Violation of the Torah. Then he makes up his own festival day to sort of substitute for Sukkoth, which is the 15th day of the 7th month. Instead, he goes for the 15th day of the 8th month. Now, you would have think if he really wanted to set up a competition, they would have been on exactly the same day. But maybe he was afraid he would lose the competition, so he just added another one a month later. You know, it's kind of like Festivus for the rest of us. It's a made-up holiday. Sorry, if you go watch Seinfeld if you don't know what I'm talking about. And it keeps just pounding away the altar he had made in the month that he alone had devised. He's making it up as he goes along with no regard for what God has sanctioned, with no regard for what God has commanded. And the motive behind this, which he stated clearly, wasn't to provide people with alternate sites of worship so that they could remain in right covenant relationship with God. This was purely politically motivated. For him, this is a way to consolidate his kingdom by giving people a viable alternative to the temple in Jerusalem. So, just, you know, your typical traipse through 1 Kings, nasty, followed by more nasty, followed by more nasty. Kind of like the weather this week. So, what are you seeing there?
I asked this before, but I'm intrigued. Those large bottles of wine were all named after these kings.
Yes. They're different size bottles of wine, as we all know, but we're most familiar with the standard size and then what's called a magnum, which is a liter and a half, and then the double magnum, which is 3 liters. And some of you might even know of an imperial, which is a 6-liter bottle of wine. But it goes beyond that. You have a Rehoboam and you have a Jeroboam, and of 12 and 15 liters, I can't remember which is which. And then, and this is, why? Maybe because after you read about these guys, you need many drinks. I don't know. In fact, maybe if we can find one, they're hard to find, if we could find a Rehoboam or a Jeroboam, somebody could bring it in next week. And then even more interesting is you have these rotten kings, but the largest bottle of wine that they make, which is 20 liters, it's about this high, is called a Nebuchadnezzar. So,
a little more serious note. Rehoboam has no idea that God is sort of going to make life awkward for him, because he wasn't told that. But Jeroboam was told if he was good, he'd be all right. So.
Well, yeah, but he wasn't.
He pretty well blew it from work down then, didn't he?
Yeah, I mean, I could see where he was going. I mean, maybe in my position I would have done the same thing. We're both sinners. But when it comes to God, and we all need to remember this, we can't make it up as we go along. And we need to search out our hearts and pursue things with right motives. For Jeroboam, it was very, very clear that he did this to try to consolidate the kingdom. He was afraid of them continuing to go to Jerusalem. And although it's not explicitly stated here, perhaps that's where God intended them to continue to go to worship for the high festival days, was to go to the temple in Jerusalem, because he has preserved Jerusalem and Judah because his name is in the city. That remains the place where the name of the Lord dwells. As he pleases. And so he's trying to replace something that God doesn't want to be replaced, would be my inference, just based on, you know, what the Lord has said about, you know, the preservation of the southern kingdom in Jerusalem. And it's kind of like sending out Adoram. Could you have picked anyone worse? You know, in this situation, I'm not sure that Jeroboam could have gone about it in a worse way. Golden calves, made up festival days, ordaining priests who are not Levites. And of course, he just...
Was this a case of free will? Or did God Jeroboam this kind of guy?
Yes, the persisting question of Samuel and Kings, and for that matter, Exodus. You know, how much of it is people making bad choices that rebel against God, and how much of it is God hardening their hearts, as he did Pharaoh, so that his will can be done? And I think that it's a little bit of both. And it's hard to see how both could be happening at the same time, but it's clear that God is guiding events. But if people like Jeroboam and Rehoboam aren't actually making choices, then how could God be offended because they're not sinning? I mean, you can't be held responsible for choices you don't make. So, in some way, it's a little bit of both. And honestly, ultimately, I don't know how to reconcile the two realities. I guess the way I see it is, God is working through these people to achieve His purposes, because He knows His material well, there's an inevitability to this, but the choices have to be made for the inevitability to be fulfilled. I guess would be, that's the best I can do. I'm sorry. Caroline?
I was going to say that, you know, Jeroboam made his political expediency and had put that ahead of God,
mm-hmm.
and because he was afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And if he had not done that, set things up the way the Lord would have wanted it to have done, he didn't know that would be that the end of his kingdom would occur. I mean, it may have been that it would not.
Well, I mean, it kept on going. I mean, Israel continued to be a separate kingdom. And it's, you're right, I mean, he did not trust God's promises.
No.
He felt like he had to do it himself. And that really is at the root of all sin. If we don't trust God to be faithful, we can't be faithful, because we will be motivated by our fears. We will assume that we will have to create our own destiny, and and that the temptation is great, and we all succumb to it. Yes.
We know nothing about them. The name pops up and he says something and does something. Tearing his robe into 12 pieces, and then we don't hear about him.
Yeah, with the emergence of the monarchy, you have the emergence of the prophets, and which are there to both validate the kingship, but also to offer a critique against the excesses and abuses of the monarchy, and now monarchies. Apart from Samuel, they just kind of float in and out of the story. As we get deeper into Kings, though, we will see the role of prophets increase with people like Elijah and Elisha, his successor, who become very, very prime players in the narrative. And we're going to learn a lot about them. They're going to have some great adventures. I can actually hardly wait. And of course, once you move out of Kings and to the remainder of the Old Testament, really the preponderance of the Old Testament consists of works by prophets. Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Hosea, Amos, these prophecies are just pounding the kings, pounding society, and they keep on harping on two things: idolatry and injustice, corruption of the courts, the exploitation of the majority of the population who are abysmally poor, to the benefit of people who were wealthy beyond all need, and of course their continual propensity to worship other gods, to hedge their bets. I trust this Yahweh God, but my buddy has had pretty good luck with this fertility god in terms of, having lots of lambs born in the spring and a nice wheat harvest in the fall. So, a few doves at his altar couldn't hurt. We think we're free from idolatry because you know, we don't have, or at least I hope you don't have, little statues in your home ensconced in a shrine where you go pray and you know, offer whatever offerings you choose. But anything in our lives that we trust more than we trust God, any priority that we put in front of God, anything that's more important to us than God, is essentially an idol. Because what it reminds me of is the old English wedding service, where a part of the vows is, "With my body I thee worship." In other words, it's the giving between husband and wife of each other's bodies. You know, I'm a married man. You know, this belongs to Stephanie. And to worship is to ascribe worth to, literally, but whatever we worship, to put it in the words of the theologian Paul Tillich, is our ultimate concern. That's how he defined God. God is your ultimate concern, before which nothing else really matters. So whether it's political power or wealth or fame, it's not that you can't have those things, you can. But if your pursuit of those aims exceed your desire to serve God, then you are an idolater. But Jen?
Going back to the statements about the prophets that are coming up, and there's so many prophets, and the condition of the of their known world was so similar to the condition of our known world today, makes me wonder. I'm sure that God maybe provides, I don't know if that's the right word, prophets continually in the world. Who are our prophets now? How do you know which prophets to trust? When I say prophet, I don't mean necessarily religious leaders.
Yeah.
But there are probably prophets out there.
Oh, yes.
Trying to warn us, trying to guide us, that we don't listen to.
Paul in his letters is quite clear that among the gifts of the Spirit is the gift of prophecy. And prophecy is oftentimes misunderstood as like a soothsayer, you know, somebody who can magically see into the future. But it's quite clear that the biblical prophets had foresight, but it was their ability to see clearly in a way that others did not what was happening in their society, how it differed from what God wanted, what the likely consequences would be if the situation wasn't changed, and what people needed to do to repent and amend the life of the nation. That's what prophets are. That's what they do. They're able to see ahead because they're given a gift of wisdom to perceive what's happening and how that's all going to play out. Okay? So, it is difficult to know prophets from false prophets. And we're warned in the New Testament about that, that there will be false prophets. To me, these people who periodically say the end time is coming, Jesus is going to come back on Tuesday morning, July the 28th of next year, these are false prophets. And it's been proven again and again and again and again. I suppose at some point there are so many of them that one of them will get lucky. But, you know, Jesus told his disciples, "I don't know when I'm coming back. Dad hasn't told me yet. And it's none of your business anyway. You're not going to know. Here are some of the signs of the times." And then the signs of the times that Jesus gave them in places like Mark chapter 13 are things that happen in every single generation. Wars and rumors of wars and famine and plague, and you know, there hasn't been a generation passed by over the last 2,000 years that hasn't experienced most, if not all, of those things. Celestial events, you know. I view Martin Luther King Jr. as a modern day prophet.
Oh, yeah, that was my next question. Mm-hmm. Among all of us here,
Who do you guys think?
Now in our time?
I mean, Desmond Tutu, for me, Desmond Tutu, who's the Archbishop of South Africa, during the period of apartheid and then after the end of apartheid and the election of Nelson Mandela as South Africa's first black president, so many awful things have happened during apartheid, and atrocities were committed on both sides. And how do you reconcile a nation to such a terrible past? Well, Archbishop Tutu was central in the formation of what was called the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Do you guys remember that? And these were a set of hearings, essentially, where an amnesty was provided for crimes if a person would confess them publicly in front of the victims or the family of the victims and apologize with sincerity. So instead of trying people for their crimes in an adversarial environment and placing them in prison, and, you know, I just imagine, because I mean, so many people were involved in these awful crimes, they would still be working it out today. And, you know, that society is not functioning well right now because of the corruption of its government, although hopefully it'll get better under its new leadership. But just imagine the chaos if they had chosen another route. Who do you believe are modern day prophets? Yeah. Yeah. I see him more as an evangelist. He wasn't entirely apolitical because he was sort of a chaplain to the presidents for a long time. But I think he tried to be a good steward of that position, and, you know, because, I mean, he was nonpartisan chaplain. It didn't matter what party the president was. He offered his counsel and comfort to them. But, yeah, I could see that.
And what about our illustrious bishop who officiated at the wedding of the royals?
Michael Curry, yeah.
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 Well, to Jan's point specifically, are there writers or authors that you would recommend that we choose to read, mm-hmm. maybe enlighten us as either a prophet or someone?
Well, if you want to read about prophets, the biblical prophets, I don't think you could do better than Abraham Joshua Heschel. And he's written a book called The Prophets. And it's superb. In terms of Heschel's dead. In terms of contemporary prophets who are authors, I would have to recommend Walter Brueggemann. He was a professor at the Duke University Seminary. I know how many of you feel about Duke, but, you know, we have to differentiate the basketball from the academic side of things. I've seen him speak. He is electric. And Brueggemann, oh yeah, here we go. Brueggemann. You almost want to say, sir, you have redundant consonants in your name. He's written extensively, and I'm trying to think. There are a couple of books in particular that are just not... But, you know, go online to Amazon or wherever it is you shop for your books, because you will not find his work in brick-and-mortar stores. You will not find his work in brick and mortar stores, at least not these particular works. But these are written for general audiences. There's not a lot of scholar speak in them. And they're generally pretty short, between 200 and 300 pages, you know. And you may not agree with everything that he has to say. And I'm not sure that he himself would regard himself as a prophet. I don't know. He amazes me. And I just have to tell a little story and then when I went to see him, he was at the big Presbyterian church on East Main in Lexington. I was in college. And a buddy and I went to see him. He's an Old Testament scholar. And it just blew us away. And then afterwards, there was a reception in his honor in their parish hall. And Jonathan and I went back there. And we were not members of that church. And obviously, you know, people were just swarming him, you know, asking him questions and stuff like that. And we were kind of over in a corner alone, munching on a chocolate chip cookie and drinking a cup of coffee. And he excuses himself. He's literally surrounded by people. He excuses himself, walks across the room in a beeline towards us. And he says, "Hi, I'm Walter. You boys look like you might be in school, you know. We brought you out here today." And, you know, we were young, and so Jonathan and I were like, we left the building, we're like, "Oh my God, oh my God, oh my God, I touched Walter Brueggemann, I touched Walter Brueggemann." But that's the kind of guy he is. He's a real sweet guy. And you do need to know that, because he's got an edge. When you read his writings, the man's got an edge. You're not going to agree with everything he says. I don't. But so worthwhile. I'll try to bring up some of his books next week. I'll try to remember to do that. Who else might be a modern prophet? Don't.
The person you wrote a book. Who was that?
The book, The Prophets.
Yes.
That's Abraham Joshua Heschel. It's H-E-S-C-H-E-L.
Is there a Kuiper?
Kuiper?
Kuiper. I've been doing so much Reform theology on this.
I can't think of a Kuiper.
You know, the sovereignty versus free will, they will never be reconciled. Because both are in here.
Yeah.
It's just in the mystery of God how they are held together.
I agree. I mean, sovereignty and free will is...
I mean, in that Arminian and Calvin, you know, it's kind of the bottom end of all of that tension is sovereignty and free will, where you land. You got scriptures for both camps.
Yeah, I mean, I can't remember who it was, and maybe you guys do, but the paradox between sovereignty and free will, someone once, I think he wrote, the sign of a first-rate mind is the ability to hold two completely contradictory things in one's mind simultaneously. And I would not say that you need a first-rate mind to do that. I would say that you need faithful imagination as a Christian to hold some of these unresolvable paradoxes within your mind at the same time. I mean, one of those paradoxes is, how can a person be fully human and fully divine at the same time? I mean, the Council of Chalcedon in 451 did the best they could, you know, but some of these are unresolvable because they are beyond this. And people will say, "Oh, that's a cop-out."
It's God. It's just God.
Apart from commitment to God's will, extremity and radicality is not healthy in religion. Because when you do that, the baby's going to fly out of the tub with the water through the window every time.